WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
We're going to remember poet and novelist James Dickey. He died last Sunday at the age of 73 of complications related to lung disease. He won the National Book Award for Poetry in 1966 and is perhaps best known for his novel Deliverance, which was adapted into the 1972 film. The story is about four suburban men who take a canoe trip and are preyed on by demented backwoodsmen who rape them and shoot them with bows and arrows. In the most famous scene, the backwoodsmen are leading two of the canoers, played by John Voight and Ned Beatty, into the woods at gunpoint.
Well, gentlemen, we can talk this thing over. What is it you require of us?
Well, we require that you get your goddamn ass up in them woods.
All right, now, right look.
You hear me, Taylor.
Okay, all right.
Get up there.
All right.
Faster, boy.
Move that ass.
Take easy with that weapon you got in your hand.
You too, shut up. Come on.
Okay.
Right on.
It's all in
there.
Trouble here.
Oh, you're in trouble.
Just don't argue with him, man. Don't.
Wait. Come on. See that sapling over
here? You heard him, man. I
want you back up against this.
Is this a matter of money, you gentlemen?
We want money. We'll take the money back up against the tree.
Yeah.
Put your back.
Pretty far back
like
against
that. All right, stay just there. Now be still. Be real still.
I spoke with James Dickey in 1993 after the publication of his novel To the White Sea, about an American tail gunner whose plane is shot down over Tokyo just before the firebombing of that city during World War II. He's on his own in enemy territory. His instincts tell him to head north to the wilderness, where it's too cold for most men to live, and he stands a chance of finding safety. The novel is about how he survives against his enemies and the elements. I asked James Dickey why he was interested in that theme.
I have always been attracted to that element in fiction when someone else wrote it. And I'm not equipped to write novels of the higher crusts of society like Henry James or Edith Wharton or someone like that, or Lewis Auchincloss. I couldn't do it. I don't have the knowledge of it. And above all, I don't have the interest in it. But something like this I have a great interest in, a survival situation. The American poet Alan Tate once told me, he said, Jim, I sometimes think of my poems as commentaries on those human situations from which there's no escape. And I'm very sympathetic to that attitude, and that's what I try to comment on, too, in what I write.
Now, I think it was when you were flying missions during World War II that you first started to read poetry seriously.
Well, yes, I read a lot of things, and the things, the prose things, novels and so on that I read, had a certain quality that I liked. I could tell that I had rather read a writer named William Faulkner than one named James T. Farrell. Who's a very prosaic and matter-of-fact and rather journalistic type of a writer, then I sort of dimly recognized early on that there was some difference in kind between Faulkner and James T. Farrell. And I finally saw, after some time, that the quality that I wanted was more concentrated and better expressed in poetry than it was in prose fiction. So gradually, I sort of gravitated over to poetry and went with that more than I did any other kind of reading that I did.
Well, how did you end up reading more while you were flying missions during World War II?
Well, when you're overseas, you're in a squadron, if you're not actually flying in combat missions and so on, you have a good deal of time. We had a squadron library. There was sort of a miscellaneous assortment of your armed services editions and so on, and I read whatever was there and so on. And then when I got back from overseas in the early part of 1946, I had some money accumulated from being over there for a good while, and I went to New York and I just bought a lot of books and read them, you know, and everything just sort of built up from that.
Then you went back to college too, right?
I started all over as a first-term freshman at Vanderbilt. I had been for a semester at Clemson, where I didn't take any interest in books or intellect intellectual pursuits, poetry, anything else. I was strictly an athlete. I was kind of an average college football player, and not the best. I had my moments, but nothing, no superstar. But my main interest up to that time was sports. But the war changed everything, changed my values, and I came back, and I didn't go back to Clemson to play ball. I didn't have to play football anymore for a college education. I had the GI Bill, so I just enrolled as a freshman at Vanderbilt, which had a good intellectual and artistic tradition. I wanted what Vanderbilt had. I had no interest in what Clemson had.
When you say the war changed your values, what are some of the values that changed that affected how you lived your life afterwards?
I had the beginnings of a lifelong interest in the imagination and its works. Everything came out of those years. And when I went to Vanderbilt, I concentrated on that and went on from there.
Was it a different world, the world of literature?
Yes,
indeed. From the world of athletics that you were used to?
Yes, it certainly was different and unendingly fascinating. The more I found out, the more I wanted to find out. And it goes on today, as they say in the awful jargon of our time, as we speak.
Well, I'm sure the people were different, too, than the people who you had been used to?
Yeah, but I like them, too. I mean, I like football players and coaches and athletes and so on very much still. But my interest in them is relatively limited, and my connection with them and my social, concordance with them is relatively slight. But the main people that I find a rapport with are the people who are in some way in the arts. It doesn't have to be literature or poetry. It can be in a drama, it can be in dance, music, and so on.
Did you find a way early on in your writing to write about the physical things that interested you?
No, I wrote about things that stuck in my mind. Very early on, I came to as far as the choice of subject matter was concerned, my only rule of thumb is that if something keeps recurring to me without any apparent reason for it to keep coming back to my mind, then I know it's a potential subject because I can't get rid of it. I know that, I have to deal with it. I have to write about it in some way, whether right or wrong, good or bad.
I think you're probably best known for your novel Deliverance, and you also wrote the screenplay for the film adaptation. What was the inspiration for that story?
Well, I usually start anything I write with an image, as I said earlier, one of these obsessional images. I was sort of taking a siesta in Italy in 1962, and I saw, it just came to me. I had no intention my train of thought, such as it was not, didn't have anything to do with this. But I just saw a man standing at the top of a cliff. I didn't know how he had gotten there, whether he came from the woods at the edge. Immediately they materialized woods in the picture. I didn't know whether he had just come out to the edge of the cliff and was looking around there, or whether maybe he had come up the cliff for some reason. What would be the reason? So gradually the story took hold of me, and in a few minutes, I don't know how many, but I knew the whole story. I knew who the people were going to be. I knew where it was going to take place. I knew what was going to happen to them, pretty much, and so on. And I just made some notes and went back to sleep, and everything started working out of that beginning.
I think the scene that made the biggest impact in Deliverance, the movie, and probably in Deliverance, the novel, is the scene where one of the characters is raped.
Well, that's famous. I can't really say justly famous, but famous it is. Bobby is the boy, the salesman, is the one that is the victim. That scene isn't necessary to the novel because the reader is going to want to see something terrible happen to that man that perpetrated the rape. Billy McKinney, who played him, and I thought he did a wonderful job. I would not be averse to saying that he was the best thing in the movie, although I have great praise for everybody else in it, too. I remember when he came up on the set, and I said to him, Billy, Mr. McKinney, you have one function in this movie. That audience is going to have to hate you. He says, don't worry, Mr. Dickey, they're going to hate me. Have you ever seen anybody that you'd rather see get shot in the back with an arrow more than that guy? And so on. So he did very good. He did a good job on that. He was very convincing.
Do you think that part of what made the rape scene so shocking to audiences was the fact that it was one man raping another man?
Well, that's shocking enough. But the most shocking thing about it, and the thing that makes you so disgusted and even terrified about it, is the humiliation of the fat boy. You know, making him squeal like a pig and all that stuff. If you're going to assault somebody sexually, you don't have to do all that, you know. But the fact that he does it makes him singularly depraved and repulsive.
Do you think that this scene also, you know, played on people's fears of homosexuality?
That's not really what I had in mind at all. What I wanted to do was to have a scene which would bring into focus the most abiding and the deepest fear of people in our time and our century, which is the fear of being set upon by malicious strangers.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to happen off in the woods of North Georgia. It can happen on the streets of New York or any other city. To be assaulted by people who had just as soon kill you as look at you. In fact, some of them had rather. That's the fear of our time. And I wanted to use that motif and as a lead-in to what happens in the rest of the story.
You know, I think that's a fear that most Americans live with, and you live with it in one way in a city and in a different way in the country.
Yeah, it's much worse in the city because there's so many more people. But it's bad enough at any time or any place.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's my pleasure.
James Dickey, recorded in 1993. He died Sunday at the age of 73.